find that you have forgotten how to speak the words. A primitive part of your brain called the limbic system is thought to be involved in the control of emotions such as joy, sadness, fear, or anger. However, our knowledge of where and how the brain creates positive and negative emotions is still very limited. We do know that nerves are the wires that make up the electrical circuits in the brain. The long, thin part of a nerve is called the axon. When a nerve is stimulated, it sends an electrical signal along the axon to the end of the nerve. A nerve is much more complex than a simple wire, however. For example, a nerve may receive input from tens of thousands of other nerves. Once it is stimulated, its axon may send out signals to tens of thousands of other nerves. This is because the axon can divide and send out many branches. Each of these branches also divides into even more branches, in much the same way that the trunk of a tree divides into more and more branches. Because of this branching tendency, a single nerve in the brain may send out signals to as many as 25,000 other nerves that are located throughout the entire brain. How do the nerves in your brain communicate their electrical signals to other nerves? To understand this, take a look at Figure 17.1 on the enhancement. You can see a simplified diagram of two nerves. The region where they meet is called the synapse. You may not be familiar with that term, but don't feel intimidated by it. It just means the space between two nerves. The left-hand nerve is called the presynaptic nerve, and the right-hand nerve is called the postsynaptic nerve. Again, these terms do not have any other fancy or special meanings. They merely refer to the nerve that ends, presynaptic nerve, or begins, postsynaptic nerve, on the left or right edge of the synapse in the figure. The communication of the electrical signal across this synapse is important to our understanding of how the brain works. The synaptic region between the presynaptic nerve on the left and the postsynaptic nerve on the right is filled with fluid. This discovery was a major breakthrough in the history of neuroscience. When you think of it, this discovery is not so surprising since our bodies are made up primarily of water. However, scientists were puzzled because they knew that the electrical impulses of nerves were too weak to travel across the synaptic fluid. So how does this presynaptic nerve on the left and figure 17.1 on the enhancement send its electrical signal across the fluid-filled synapse to the postsynaptic nerve? As an analogy, imagine that you are hiking and you come to a river. You really need to get to the other side, but the water is too deep. Furthermore, there's no bridge, and it's too far to jump. How do you get to the other side? You might need a canoe, or you might have to swim for it. Nerves face a similar problem. Because their electrical impulses are too weak to jump across synapses, the nerves send little swimmers across with their messages. These little swimmers are chemicals called neurotransmitters. The nerve in Figure 17.1 in the enhancement uses a neurotransmitter called serotonin. You can see in Figure 17.1 on the enhancement that when the presynaptic nerve fires, it releases many tiny packets of serotonin into the synapse. Once released, these chemical messengers migrate or swim through a process called diffusion across the fluid-filled synapse. At the other side of the synapse, the serotonin molecules become attached to receptors on the surface of the postsynaptic nerve. This signal tells the postsynaptic nerve to fire, as illustrated in Figure 17.2 on the enhancement. Different kinds of nerves use different kinds of neurotransmitters. There are a great many of these neurotransmitters in the brain. Chemically, many of them are categorized as biogenic amines because they are manufactured from amino acids in the foods we eat. These amine transmitters are the brain's biochemical messengers. Three of the amine transmitters in the limbic emotional regions of the brain are called serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. These three transmitters have been theorized to play a role in many psychiatric disorders and have been intensively studied by psychiatric researchers. Because these chemical messengers are called biogenic amines, the theories linking them to depression or mania are sometimes referred to as the biogenic amine theories. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. How does a chemical messenger cause the postsynaptic nerve to fire once it becomes attached to the nerve? Let's imagine for a moment that the chemical transmitter in the presynaptic nerve is serotonin. I could have chosen any of them since they all work in a similar manner. On the surface of the postsynaptic nerve, there are tiny areas called serotonin receptors. You can think of these receptors as locks because they cannot be opened up without the right key. These receptors are on the membranes that form the outer surface of nerves. These nerve membranes are something like the skin that covers your body. Now, think of the serotonin as the key to the lock on the postsynaptic nerve. Just like a real key, the serotonin works only because it has a specific shape. There are many other chemicals floating around in the synaptic region, but they will not open the serotonin lock because they do not have the right molecular shape. Once the key fits into the lock opens up. This triggers additional chemical reactions that cause the postsynaptic nerve to fire electrically. When the nerve fires, the serotonin, the key, is released from the receptor, the lock, on the postsynaptic nerve, and ends in the synaptic fluid again. Finally, it swims back to the presynaptic nerve, again through a process called diffusion, as illustrated in Figure 17.3 on the enhancement. The serotonin has done its job, and the presynaptic nerve needs to get rid of it. Otherwise, it will hang around in the synapse, and it might swim back to the postsynaptic nerve again. This could create confusion because the postsynaptic nerve may think there is a new signal, and it may get stimulated to fire again. To solve this problem, the presynaptic nerve has a pump on its surface. Once the serotonin swims back, it attaches to a receptor, another lock on the surface of the presynaptic nerve, and it is pumped back into the nerve by something called the membrane pump, or the reuptake pump, as you can see in Figure 17.3 on the enhancement. After the serotonin is pumped back inside, the presynaptic nerve can recycle it, or it can destroy the excess serotonin if it already has enough saved up for the next electrical signal. It destroys the excess serotonin through a process called metabolism, which means changing one chemical into another chemical. In this case, the serotonin is changed into a chemical that can be absorbed into the bloodstream. The enzyme in the nerve that performs this service is called monoamine oxidase, or MAO for short. The MAO enzyme transforms the serotonin into a new chemical called 5-hydroxyindoleacetic acid, or 5-HIAA. That is another big name, but you can simply think of 5-HIAA as the waste product of the serotonin. The 5-HIAA leaves your brain, enters your bloodstream, and is carried to your kidneys. Your kidneys remove the 5-HIAA from your blood and send it to your bladder. Finally, you get rid of the 5-HIAA when you urinate. That's the end of the serotonin cycle. Of course, the presynaptic nerve must continually manufacture a new supply of serotonin to use in nerve firing so that the total amount of serotonin does not get depleted. What goes wrong in depression? First of all, let me reemphasize that scientists do not yet know the cause of depression or any other psychiatric disorder. There are lots of interesting theories, but none of them has yet been proven. One day we may have the answer and look back on the thinking of this era as a quaint historical curiosity. However, science has to start somewhere, and research on the brain is moving forward at an explosive rate. New and very different theories will undoubtedly emerge in the next decade. The explanations in this section will be very simplified. The brain is enormously complex, and our knowledge about how it works is still extremely primitive. There is a vast amount we do not know about the brain's hardware and software. How does the firing of a nerve or a series of nerves get translated into a thought or a feeling? This is one of the deepest mysteries of science, as amazing to me as questions about the origin of the universe. We won't even attempt to answer those questions here. For the moment, our goals are much more humble. If you understood Figures 17.1 to 17.3, it should be pretty easy for you to understand current theories about what goes wrong in depression. You have already learned that nerves in the brain send messages to each other with chemical messengers called neurotransmitters. You also know that some of the nerves in the limbic system of the brain use serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine as their chemical messengers. Some scientists have hypothesized that depression may result from a deficiency of one or more of these biogenic amine transmitter substances in the brain, while mania, states of extreme euphoria or elation, may result from an excess of one or more of them. Some researchers believe that serotonin plays the most important role in depression and mania. Others believe that abnormalities in norepinephrine or dopamine also play a role. A corollary of these biogenic amine theories is that antidepressant drugs may work by boosting the levels of activity of serotonin, norepinephrine, or dopamine in depressed patients. We will talk some more about how these drugs work in a little while. What would happen if a chemical messenger, such as serotonin, became depleted from the presynaptic nerve in Figure 17.1? Then this nerve could not send its nerve signals properly across the synapses to the postsynaptic nerve. The wiring in the brain would develop faulty connections, and the result would be mental and emotional static, much like the music that comes out of a radio with a loose wire in the tuner. One type of emotional static, serotonin deficiency, would cause depression, and another type of static, serotonin excess, would cause mania. Recently, these amine theories have been modified quite a bit. Some scientists no longer believe that a deficiency or excess of serotonin causes depression or mania. Instead, they postulate that abnormalities in one or more of the receptors on the nerve membranes may lead to mood abnormalities. Examine Figure 17.2 again, and imagine that there is something wrong with the serotonin receptors on the postsynaptic nerve. For example, there might not be enough of them. What would happen to the communication between the nerves? Although there might be plenty of serotonin molecules in the synapse, the postsynaptic nerves might not fire consistently when the presynaptic nerves fired. And if there were too many serotonin receptors, this could have the opposite effect of causing overactivity in the serotonin system. To date, at least 15 different kinds of serotonin receptors have been identified throughout the brain, and more are being identified all the time. All these receptors probably have different effects on hormones, feelings, and behavior. Scientists do not have a very clear picture of what any of these different receptors do, nor do they know if abnormalities in any of them play a causal role in depression or mania. Research in this area is evolving at an extremely rapid pace, and we will have better information about the physiologic and psychological effects of these many serotonin receptors in the near future. Although our knowledge about the role of serotonin receptors in brain function is still quite limited, there is evidence that the number of receptors on the postsynaptic nerves may change in response to antidepressant drug therapy. For example, if you give a drug that boosts the levels of serotonin in the synapses between the nerves, the number of serotonin receptors on the postsynaptic nerve membranes will decrease after a few weeks. This might be a way that the nerves attempt to compensate for the excess stimulation. The nerves are trying to turn down the volume of the signal, so to speak. This kind of reaction is called downregulation. In contrast, if you deplete the serotonin from the presynaptic nerve in Figure 17.1, much less serotonin will be released into the synapse. After several weeks, the postsynaptic nerves may compensate by increasing the number of serotonin receptors. The nerves are trying to turn up the volume of the signal. This kind of reaction is called upregulation. Again, these are big words with simple meanings. Upregulation means more receptors, and downregulation means fewer receptors. We could also say that upregulation means turning the system up, and downregulation means turning the system down, just like a radio. It is known that antidepressant drugs usually require several weeks or more to become effective. Researchers have been trying to figure out why. Some researchers have speculated that downregulation may account for the antidepressant effects of these drugs. In other words, antidepressants may work not because they boost the serotonin system as originally proposed, but because they turn the serotonin system down after several weeks. This would imply that decreased serotonin levels might not be the cause of depression after all. Depression might instead be due to increased serotonin activity in the brain. Antidepressant drugs may correct this after several weeks because they turn the serotonin system down. How well established and proven are these theories? Not at all. As I have suggested, it is awfully easy to make up a theory, but much harder to prove it. To date, it has not been possible to validate or disprove any of these theories in a convincing way. In addition, there are no clinical or laboratory tests we could give to groups of patients or to individual patients that will reliably detect any chemical imbalance that causes depression. The main value of the current theories is to stimulate research so that our knowledge of brain function will become more sophisticated over time. Eventually, I believe we will develop much more refined theories and far better tools for testing them. Now, you may be thinking, is that all there is to it? Do scientists just sit around and say, depression could be due to an excess or a deficiency of this or that transmitter or receptor in the brain? On some level, that really is all there is to it. Part of the problem is that our models of the brain are still very primitive, and so our theories of depression are not yet very sophisticated either. It may turn out that depression is not due to problems with any transmitter chemical or receptor. We may one day discover that depression is actually more of a software problem and not a hardware problem. In other words, if you have a computer, you know that computers crash all the time. Sometimes this results from a problem with the hardware. For example, your hard drive may become defective. But more often there's a problem with the software, a bug that makes the program work poorly in certain situations. So with regard to brain research on depression, we may be looking for a problem in the hardware, for example, a chemical imbalance we are born with, whereas the real problem is in the software, for example, a negative thinking pattern based on learning. Both kinds of problems would be organic, since brain tissue is involved, but the solutions to them would be radically different. Another major problem facing depression researchers is the chicken versus the egg dilemma. Are changes we measure in the brain the cause of the depression, or the result? To illustrate this problem, let's conduct a thought experiment involving a deer in a forest. The deer is happy and contented. Imagine that we have a special machine that allows us to visualize the chemical and electrical activity in the deer's brain. We might have, for example, a futuristic portable brain imaging machine that can work from a distance, like the laser guns the police use to see how fast you're driving. However, the deer does not know we are monitoring its brain activity. Suddenly, the deer spots a pack of hungry wolves approaching. Panic strikes. Our brain imaging machine detects instantaneous, massive changes in the electrical and chemical activity in the deer's brain. Are these chemical and electrical changes the cause of the fear or the result of the fear? Would we say the deer is afraid because it has developed a sudden chemical imbalance in its brain? Similarly, there are all kinds of chemical and electrical changes in the brains of depressed patients. Our brains change quite dramatically when we feel happy, angry, or frightened. Which brain changes result from the strong emotions we feel, and which brain changes are the causes? Separating cause from effect is one of the thorniest challenges facing depression researchers. This problem is not impossible to solve, but it is not easy. And those eager to endorse the current theories about depression do not always acknowledge it. Clearly, the research necessary to test any of these theories can be daunting. One significant problem is that it is still very difficult to get accurate information about the chemical and electrical process in the human brain. We can't just open up the brain of a depressed individual and look inside. And even if we could, we really wouldn't know where or how to look. But new tools such as PET, positron emission tomography, scanning, and MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, do make such research possible. For the first time, scientists can begin to see the activity of nerves and chemical processes inside the brains of human beings. This research is still in its infancy, and we can look forward to a great deal of progress in the next decade. How do antidepressant drugs work? The modern era of research on the chemistry of depression got a big boost, accidentally, in the early 1950s, when researchers were testing a new drug for tuberculosis called iproniazid. As it turned out, iproniazid was not an effective treatment for tuberculosis. However, the investigators noticed pronounced mood elevations in a number of patients who received this drug, and hypothesized that iproniazid might have antidepressant properties. This led to an explosion of research by drug companies who wanted to be the first to develop and market antidepressant drugs. Researchers knew that iproniazid was an inhibitor of the MAO enzyme discussed previously. The drug was therefore categorized as an MAO inhibitor, or MAOI for short. Several new MAOI drugs that were similar in chemical structure to iproniazid were developed. Two of them, phenylzine, Nardal, and tranylcypramine, Parnate, are still in use today. A third MAOI called selegiline, trade named Eldepril, has been approved for the treatment of Parkinson's disease. This drug is also occasionally used in the treatment of mood disorders. Other new MAOIs in use abroad may eventually be marketed in the United States. The MAOIs are no longer prescribed nearly as frequently as they used to be. This is because they can cause dangerous elevations of blood pressure if the patient combines them with certain foods, such as cheese. The MAOIs can also cause toxic reactions when combined with certain drugs. Because of these hazards, newer and safer antidepressants have been developed. These new drugs work quite differently from the MAOIs. Nevertheless, the MAOIs can be extremely helpful for some depressed patients who do not respond to other medications, and they can be used safely if the patient and doctor follow a number of guidelines that I will spell out in Chapter 20. The iproniazid discovery helped to usher in a new era of biological research on depression. Scientists were eager to find out how the MAOIs worked. It was known that the MAOIs prevented the breakdown of serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine, the three chemical messengers that are concentrated in the limbic regions of the brain. Scientists hypothesized that a deficiency in one or more of these substances might cause depression and that antidepressant drugs might work by increasing the levels of these substances. This is how the biogenic amine theories actually originated. Now let's see how much you've learned about how the brain works. Look at figures 17.1 to 17.3 again. When the presynaptic nerve fires, serotonin is released into the synapse. After it attaches to a receptor on the postsynaptic nerve, it swims back to the presynaptic nerve, where it is pumped back inside this nerve and destroyed by the MAO enzyme. Now ask yourself this question. What would happen if we prevented the MAO enzyme from destroying the serotonin? As you have probably guessed, the serotonin would accumulate in the presynaptic nerve because this nerve is always manufacturing new serotonin. If this nerve could not get rid of its serotonin, the concentration of serotonin in the nerve would continue to increase. Whenever the presynaptic nerve fired, it would release much more serotonin than usual into the fluid-filled synaptic region. The excess serotonin in the synapse would cause a greater-than-expected stimulation of the postsynaptic nerve. This would be the chemical equivalent of turning up the volume on the radio. These effects of the MAOI antidepressants are illustrated in Figure 17.4 on the enhancement. Could this be the reason the MAOI drugs cause a mood elevation? This is possible, and scientists have hypothesized that this is exactly how these MAOI drugs work. Research studies have confirmed that when these MAOI drugs are given to humans or animals, brain levels of serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine do increase. However, it is not known for certain if the antidepressant effects result from an increase in one of these biogenic amines or from some other effect of these drugs on the brain. Can you think of another theory about why or how these MAOI drugs might work? Does the increase in mood have to result from the extra stimulation of the postsynaptic nerve? Or could there be another possible explanation? Think about what you read about downregulation in the previous section and see if you can come up with an answer before you read any further. You probably recall that the effects on the postsynaptic nerves after several weeks can be the opposite of the effects on these nerves when you first take a drug. All the extra serotonin in the synapse may cause a downregulation of the postsynaptic serotonin receptors after several weeks, and this downregulation may correspond to the antidepressant effects. Remember that although some scientists think depression results from a serotonin deficiency, others believe depression results from increased brain serotonin activity. If you thought of this, it shows you are really learning your neurochemistry. You get an A+ on this pop quiz. If you said that the antidepressant effects of the MAOI drug could result from effects on some other system in the brain, you also get an A+. These theories about how the antidepressant drugs relieve depression are not proven facts. The effects of the MAOIs on the brain are vastly more complex than the simple model depicted in Figure 17.4. The effects of any antidepressant are probably not limited to one specific region or one specific type of nerve in the brain. Remember that each nerve in the brain connects with many thousands of other nerves, and all of them in turn connect with thousands of others. When you take an antidepressant, there are massive changes in numerous chemical and electrical systems throughout your brain. Any of these changes could be responsible for the improvement in your mood. Trying to figure out exactly how these drugs work is still a little like looking for a needle in a haystack. But the important thing for the moment is that these drugs do seem to help some depressed patients, regardless of how or why they work. As I have mentioned, many new and different kinds of antidepressant drugs have been developed and marketed since the 1950s. Unlike the MAOIs, the newer antidepressants do not cause a buildup of transmitters like serotonin in the presynaptic nerve depicted in Figure 17.4. Instead, they mimic the effects of the brain's natural transmitter substances by attaching to receptors on the surfaces of the presynaptic or postsynaptic nerves. To understand how these newer antidepressants can do this, remember our analogy of the lock and the key. A natural transmitter substance is like a key, and the receptor on the surface of the nerve is like a lock. The key is able to unlock the lock only because it has a certain shape. But if you were a magician, like the famous Harry Houdini, you could easily pick the lock and open it without the key. An antidepressant medication is like a counterfeit key that a drug company has manufactured. Because the chemists know the three-dimensional shape of a natural transmitter like serotonin, norepinephrine, or dopamine, they can create new drugs that have a very similar shape. These drugs will fit into the receptors on the surfaces of nerves and mimic the effects of the natural transmitters. The brain does not know that an antidepressant is in the lock. The brain has been tricked into thinking that the natural transmitter chemical is attached to the receptor on the surface of the nerve. In theory, the artificial key, the antidepressant, can do one of two things when it becomes attached to the receptor. It can either open the lock, or it can jam the lock without actually opening it. Drugs that open the locks are called agonists. Agonists are simply drugs that mimic the effects of the natural transmitters. Drugs that jam up these locks are called antagonists. Antagonists block the effects of the natural transmitters and prevent them from being effective. We can imagine several different ways that antidepressant drugs could influence the receptors on the presynaptic and postsynaptic nerves. For the purpose of this discussion, imagine that the transmitter used by the presynaptic nerve is serotonin, but the same considerations apply to any transmitter. What would happen if we blocked the receptors on the reuptake pump? The presynaptic nerve could no longer pump the serotonin from the synapse back inside. Each time the nerve fired, more and more serotonin would be released into the synaptic region. As a result, the synapse would get flooded with serotonin. This is precisely how most of the currently prescribed antidepressants work. As you can see in Figure 17.5 on the enhancement, they block the receptors for the reuptake pumps on presynaptic nerves, and so the transmitters build up in the synaptic region. The end result of this process is similar to the effects of giving the MAOI drugs discussed above. In both instances, the levels of serotonin build up in the synaptic region. When the presynaptic nerve fires, more serotonin than normal will swim to the postsynaptic nerve and stimulate it to fire. Once again, we have turned up the serotonin system, so to speak. Is this good? Is this why these antidepressant drugs can improve our moods? That's the current theory. But no one really knows the answers to this question yet. Different antidepressants block different amine pumps, and some of them have more specific effects than others. The older tricyclic antidepressants, such as amitriptyline, Elavil, or imipramine, Tofranil, and others, block the reuptake pumps for serotonin and norepinephrine. Tricyclic means three wheels, like a tricycle, because the chemical structure of these drugs resembles three linked rings. Therefore, these transmitters build up in the brain if you take one of these drugs. Some tricyclic antidepressants have relatively stronger effects on the serotonin pump, and some of them have relatively stronger effects on the norepinephrine pump. Drugs with stronger effects on the serotonin pump are called serotonergic, and drugs with relatively stronger effects on the norepinephrine pump are called noradrenergic. What do you think we would call a drug with a strong effect on the dopamine pump? If you guessed dopaminergic, you would be correct. Some of the newer antidepressants, such as fluoxetine, Prozac, differ from the older tricyclic compounds in that they have highly selective and specific effects on the serotonin pump. If we want to use one of our new words, we can say that Prozac is highly serotonergic because levels of serotonin will build up in the brain when you take it. However, because Prozac blocks only the serotonin pump, the levels of other transmitters, such as norepinephrine and dopamine, will not build up. Prozac is classified as a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, SSRI for short, because of its selective and specific effects on the serotonin pump. Again, SSRI is an intimidating name with a humble meaning. SSRI means this drug blocks only the serotonin pump, and it doesn't block any other pumps. 5 SSRIs are currently prescribed in the United States, and I will discuss them in detail in Chapter 20. Some new antidepressants are not so selective. They block more than one type of reuptake pump. For example, venlafaxine, Effexor, blocks the serotonin and norepinephrine pumps, so it has been called a dual reuptake inhibitor. The drug company that manufactures venlafaxine promotes the idea that this drug may be more effective because the levels of two transmitters, serotonin and norepinephrine, increase rather than just one. Actually, this is not such a novel feature. As you just learned, most of the older and much cheaper antidepressants do exactly the same thing. In addition, there is no evidence that venlafaxine works any better or any faster than the older drugs. However, venlafaxine has fewer side effects than some of the older tricyclic antidepressants. This might justify the increased cost of venlafaxine in some instances. So far, you have learned about the MAOIs and the pump inhibitors, such as the tricyclics and the SSRIs. Are there any other ways that antidepressant drugs might work? If you were a chemist working for a drug company and you wanted to create a completely novel antidepressant, what kinds of effects would your new drug have? One possibility would be to create a drug that directly stimulated the serotonin receptors on the postsynaptic nerves. A drug like this would mimic the effect of the natural serotonin. It would be a kind of counterfeit serotonin. Buspirone, Buspar, works like this. This drug directly stimulates serotonin receptors on postsynaptic nerves. Buspirone was marketed a number of years ago as the first non-addictive drug for anxiety, but it also has some mild antidepressant effects. However, its antidepressant and anti-anxiety properties are not especially strong. As a result, buspirone has not emerged as a particularly popular drug for anxiety or depression. Why is it that buspirone is not more effective for depression? Scientists don't really know the answer. Remember, though, that there are at least 15 different kinds of serotonin receptors throughout the brain. All of these receptors have different functions that are not yet fully understood. Perhaps drugs that stimulated different kinds of serotonin receptors would have stronger antidepressant effects. As you might have gathered, things get complicated fairly quickly as we learn more and more about how the brain works. If you were a drug company chemist, you could also create drugs that blocked the serotonin receptors on the postsynaptic nerves, as illustrated in Figure 17.6 on the enhancement. Because such drugs would prevent the natural serotonin from having its effects, they would, theoretically, make depression worse. In fact, drugs that block serotonin receptors have been created. Two of them are called nifazodone, serazone, and trazodone, Deseril. Although they are categorized as serotonin antagonists, these drugs are also used as antidepressants. Some drugs have complex effects on several kinds of pre- and post-synaptic nerve receptors. Mirtazapine, Remeron, is another new antidepressant that has been available in the United States since 1996. Mirtazapine appears to block serotonin receptors on the post-synaptic nerves, but it also stimulates receptors on presynaptic nerves that use norepinephrine as a transmitter. This causes an increase in the release of norepinephrine by these nerves. So when you take mirtazapine, the serotonin system gets turned down and the norepinephrine system gets turned up. The antidepressant effects of nifazodone, trazodone, and mirtazapine are exactly the opposite of what you might predict from the serotonin theory. Although they turn the serotonin system off, they aren't antidepressants. How can this be possible? If you are starting to get confused, join the club. Remember that there are many types of serotonin receptors in the brain, and they all have different kinds of effects. Remember, too, that there are many high-speed and complex interactions among the different circuits in the brain. When we perturb one system of nerves in one region of the brain, we almost instantly create changes in thousands or millions of other nerves in other regions of the brain. In the final analysis, even the world's top neuroscientists do not have a very clear understanding of why or how these drugs relieve depression. In summary, most of the currently prescribed antidepressants have effects on the serotonin, norepinephrine, or dopamine systems. Some of them are highly selective for one transmitter system, and others have effects on many transmitter systems. However, the effects of the currently prescribed antidepressants on these three systems do not really account for their beneficial effects in a very consistent or convincing way. For example, you have learned that some antidepressants stimulate serotonin levels, some of them block serotonin receptors, and some of them seem to have no effects at all on serotonin. And yet they all work about equally well. Clearly, the models I have drawn in figures 17.4 to 17.6 in the enhancement are overly simplified, and current theories about how antidepressant medications work appear to be incomplete at best. I do not mean to sound overly negative. Keep in mind that I am not challenging the effectiveness of the currently prescribed antidepressant drugs. I am simply saying that our theories about how these drugs work do not account for all the facts. Fortunately, most neuroscience researchers now acknowledge this. The focus of research has expanded greatly. Instead of focusing narrowly on levels of one or another biogenic amine, researchers are pursuing a wide variety of strategies which focus on regulatory mechanisms throughout the brain, and new theories have been proposed. These theories deal with other transmitters in the brain or with a variety of pre- or post-synaptic receptors, or with second messenger systems within the nerves, or with ion flux across nerve membranes, as well as with neuroendocrine systems, immune systems, and biological rhythm abnormalities. I believe the wider net that has now been cast will eventually lead to much better understanding of how the brain regulates moods. Sophistication in brain research has accelerated tremendously and will accelerate even more rapidly in the next decade. This research will hopefully lead to improvements such as these. Clinical tests for the chemical imbalance that causes depression, if indeed such an imbalance actually exists. Tests to detect the genetic abnormalities that make certain individuals more vulnerable to depression as well as manic depressive illness. Safer medications with fewer side effects, as you will learn in Chapter 20. Significant advances have already been made in this area. Drugs and psychotherapeutic treatments that are more effective and faster acting. Drugs and psychotherapeutic treatments that minimize or entirely prevent relapses of depression following recovery. Although our current level of understanding is still primitive, an important scientific effort has been launched. One day this effort may even lead us to the identification of the mysterious black bile. Chapter 18. The Mind-Body Problem. Ever since the time of the French philosopher René Descartes, scholars have been puzzled by the mind-body problem. This is the idea that as human beings we have at least two separate levels of existence, our minds and our bodies. Our minds consist of our thoughts and our feelings, which are invisible or ethereal. We know they are there because we can experience them, but we do not know why or how they exist. In contrast, our bodies consist of tissue, blood, bones, muscle, fat, and so forth. The tissue ultimately consists of molecules, and the molecules are ultimately made up of atoms. These building blocks are inert. Presumably, atoms have no consciousness. So how can the inert tissue in our brains give rise to our conscious minds, which can see, feel, hear, love, and hate? According to Descartes, our minds and bodies must be connected in some manner. Descartes called a portion of the brain that links these two separate entities the seat of the soul. For centuries, philosophers have tried to locate the seat of the soul. In the modern era, neuroscientists continue this search as they attempt to figure out how our brains create emotions and conscious thoughts. The belief that our minds and bodies are separate is reflected in our treatments for problems such as depression. We have biological treatments which work on the body, and psychological treatments, which work on the mind. Biological treatments usually involve medications, and psychological treatments usually involve some type of talking therapy. There is often intense competition between the drug therapy camp and the talking therapy camp. On the average, psychiatrists are more likely to be in the drug therapy camp. This is because psychiatrists are first trained as physicians, MDs. They can prescribe medications, and they are more likely to be influenced by the medical model of diagnosis and treatment. If you are depressed and you go to a psychiatrist, there's a good chance that she or he will tell you that your depression is caused by a chemical imbalance in your brain, and will recommend treatment with an antidepressant medication. If your family physician treats your depression, drug treatment is also very likely. This is because many family physicians have little training in psychotherapy and very little time to talk to patients about the problems in their lives. In contrast, psychologists, clinical social workers, and other types of counselors are more likely to be in the talking therapy camp. They do not have medical training and cannot prescribe medications. Their education usually focuses more on the psychological and social factors that may cause depression. If you are depressed and you go to a therapist in the talking therapy camp, she or he is more likely to focus on your upbringing, your attitudes, or stressful events such as the loss of love or the loss of your job. Your therapist will probably also recommend psychotherapeutic treatment, such as cognitive behavioral therapy. However, there are many exceptions to this generalization. Many non-medical therapists believe that biological factors do play a role in depression, and many psychiatrists are gifted psychotherapists. Psychiatrists and non-medical therapists sometimes work together in teams so that their patients can benefit from both types of treatment. Nevertheless, the split between the mind, psychological, and body, biological, schools is sharp, and the dialogue between them is often intense, combative, and bitter. Political and financial considerations sometimes seem to influence the tone of these discussions more than scientific findings. Some recent studies suggest that these arguments may amount to much ado about nothing, and that the dichotomy between the mind and the brain may be illusory. These studies indicate that antidepressant drugs and psychotherapy may have similar effects on our minds and on our brains. In other words, they might work in the same way. For example, in a classic study published in the Archives of General Psychiatry in 1992, Drs. Louis R. Baxter, Jr., Jeffrey M. Schwartz, Kenneth S. Bergman, and their colleagues at UCLA School of Medicine studied changes in the brain chemistry of 18 patients with obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD. Half of these patients were treated with cognitive behavioral therapy and no drugs, and half were treated with antidepressant drugs and no psychotherapy. The patients in the no drug group received individual and group psychotherapy that had two main components. The first component was exposure and response prevention. This is a behavior therapy technique which involves encouraging patients not to give in to their compulsive urges to check locks, to wash their hands repeatedly, and so forth. The second component was cognitive therapy along the lines described in this book. Remember that patients in this group did not receive any medications at all. These investigators used positron emission tomography, PET scanning, to study the metabolic rate for sugar, glucose, in various brain regions before and after 10 weeks of treatment, with either drugs or psychotherapy. This method of brain scanning assesses the activity of the nerves in different areas of the brain. One brain region they were particularly interested in was the caudate nucleus on the right half of the brain. Both treatments were effective. The majority of patients in both groups improved, and there were no significant differences in the two treatments. This was not surprising. Previous researchers have also reported that drugs and cognitive behavioral psychotherapy have similar effects in the treatment of OCD. However, the results of the PET study were quite surprising. The investigators reported comparable reductions in the activity in the right caudate nucleus in the successfully treated patients, regardless of whether they were treated with drugs and no psychotherapy, or psychotherapy and no drugs. In addition, the symptoms and thinking patterns of the two groups improved to a similar degree. Neither treatment was superior. Finally, the amount of improvement in symptoms was significantly correlated with the degree of change in the right caudate nucleus. In other words, patients who improved the most had, on average, the greatest reductions in brain activity in the right caudate nucleus. The reduced activity meant that the nerves in this region of the brain had calmed down, regardless of whether they were treated with drugs or psychotherapy. One implication of this study is that excessive activity in the right caudate nucleus might play a role in the development or maintenance of the symptoms of obsessive-compulsive disorder. A second important implication is that antidepressant medications and cognitive behavioral therapy might be equally effective in restoring the structure and function of the brain back to normal. Like most published studies, this one had some fairly significant flaws. One problem is that any brain changes you observe in a particular psychiatric disorder might simply represent downstream effects rather than true causal effects. In other words, the increased neural activity in the right caudate nuclei of patients with obsessive-compulsive disorder might simply reflect a more general pattern of distress throughout the brain and may not be the cause of the symptoms, as we have discussed above. Another problem was that the number of patients studied was extremely small, and the number of brain regions the investigators studied was fairly large. So it is possible, even likely, that these findings were the result of chance. This possibility is consistent with the fact that other investigators have reported different patterns of brain activity in patients treated with antidepressant medications. This is why replications with more patients conducted by independent investigators are needed before the results of any study can be accepted. In spite of these limitations, the report by Dr. Baxter and his colleagues was the first of its kind and may open the door to an important new type of integrated research on the ways that drugs and psychotherapy can influence brain function and emotions. Other studies have shown that antidepressants may actually work by helping depressed patients change their negative thinking patterns. Indeed, in an investigation conducted at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Drs. Ann D. Simons, Saul L. Garfield, and George E. Murphy randomly assigned depressed patients to treatment with either antidepressants alone or cognitive therapy alone. They studied changes in the negative thinking patterns of both groups of patients. They discovered that the negative thinking of patients who responded to the antidepressants improved as much as the negative thinking of depressed patients who responded to the cognitive therapy. Remember that the drug patients received no psychotherapy, and the cognitive therapy patients received no medications. Thus, this study indicated that antidepressant drugs change negative thinking patterns in much the same way that cognitive therapy does. The effect of antidepressant drugs on attitudes and thoughts may explain their antidepressant effects just as well or even better than more biological explanations of their effects on different transmitter systems in the brain. These remarkable studies suggest that we might do better to let go of this mind-body split and begin to think about how these different treatments may be working in tandem on the mind and on the brain. This combined approach could foster a greater sense of teamwork among therapists and researchers approaching the problem from different angles, and may lead to more rapid advances in our understanding of emotional disorders. Even if there is some type of genetic or biological disorder in at least some depressions, psychotherapy can often help to correct these problems, even without medications. Many research studies, as well as my own clinical experience, have confirmed that severely depressed patients who appear very biologically depressed with lots of physical symptoms often respond rapidly to cognitive therapy alone, without any drugs. It can work the other way as well. I have worked with many depressed patients who were still stuck after I had tried numerous psychotherapeutic interventions. When I prescribed an antidepressant medication, many of these patients started to turn the corner, and the psychotherapy began to work better. It seemed as if the medication really did help them change their negative thinking patterns as they recovered from the depression. If depression is inherited, doesn't it mean we should treat it with drugs? In Chapter 17, we talked about the fact that we don't yet know how strong the genetic influences are in the more common forms of depression that do not involve mania. But suppose scientists eventually discover that nearly all forms of depression are inherited, at least in part. Would it mean we should treat depression with drugs? The answer is not necessarily. For example, a blood phobia is thought to be at least partially genetic, but it can nearly always be treated quickly and easily with behavior therapy. The treatment of choice for most phobias is to expose the person to the frightening situation and to urge them to face it and endure the anxiety until the fear diminishes and disappears. Most patients are so frightened that they resist the treatment at first, but if they can be persuaded to hang in there, the success rate is extraordinarily high. I can attest to this personally. While growing up, I was terrified of blood. When in medical school it was time to draw blood from each other's arms, I felt so unenthusiastic that I dropped out of medical school. For the next year, I decided to work in the clinical laboratory of the Stanford University Hospital so I could try to get over my fear. They gave me a job doing nothing but drawing blood out of people's arms, and I had to do this all day long. The first few times I had to draw blood, it made me very anxious. But after those initial anxious moments, I got used to it. Pretty soon, I loved my new job. This shows that at least some genetic tendencies can respond to a behavioral treatment without drugs. To state an even more commonplace example, we all inherit a tendency to have a particular type of body. Some of us are genetically taller or shorter than others. Some of us have larger frames, others have smaller frames. but our diets and habits hugely influence the types of bodies we have as adults. Many professional bodybuilders were skinny and embarrassed about their looks when growing up. This motivated them to go to the gym and work out. This intense effort transformed many of them into champions. Their genes may have greatly influenced what they were born with, but their behaviors and determination dominated where they ended up. The opposite is also true. If it turned out that depression was entirely caused by the environment and that there were no genetic influences, this would not minimize the potential value of antidepressant drugs. For example, if you are exposed to someone with a strep throat, you may get a strep throat because streptococcal bacteria are so infectious. We can say that the causes of your strep throat are almost entirely environmental and not genetic. Nevertheless, we would still treat your strep throat with an antibiotic and not with behavior therapy. With regard to bipolar manic depressive illness, the answer is clear. This disorder appears to have an extremely strong biological cause, and although we don't yet know exactly what this cause may be, treatment with a mood stabilizer such as lithium or valproic acid, Depakine, is usually a must. Other medications will also be used during episodes of depression or severe mania. However, good psychotherapy can also make a big contribution in the treatment of bipolar illness. In my experience, the combination of a drug like lithium or valproic acid, along with cognitive therapy, has been far more effective than treatment with medications alone. From a practical point of view, the question I face as a clinician is this: how can I best treat each particular patient who is suffering from depression, regardless of the cause? Whether or not genes play a role, drugs can sometimes help, and psychotherapy can sometimes help. Sometimes a combination of psychotherapy and antidepressant medications seems to be the best approach. Is it better to be treated with drugs or psychotherapy? A number of studies have compared the effectiveness of antidepressant drug treatment with cognitive therapy. On the whole, these studies have indicated that during the acute phase of treatment, when patients first seek treatment for their depressions, both treatments seem to work reasonably well. Following recovery, the picture is a little different. Several long-term studies indicate that patients who receive cognitive therapy, alone or in combination with antidepressant medications, appear to stay undepressed longer than patients who receive only antidepressant medication therapy and no psychotherapy. This is probably because cognitively treated patients have learned many coping tools to help them deal with any mood problems they might experience in the future. If you would like to learn more about recent research on the effectiveness of drugs versus psychotherapy, you can read an excellent article on this topic by Drs. David O. Antonuccio and William G. Danton from the University of Nevada, and Dr. Gerlin Y. Donelsky from the Cleveland Clinic. These authors reviewed the world research literature on the effectiveness of psychotherapy versus medications for depression and came up with some rather startling conclusions that are quite different from the popular perceptions about these treatments. They argue that cognitive therapy appears to be at least as effective, if not more effective, than medications in the treatment of depression. They conclude that this is even true for severe depressions that appear to be biological because they have many physical side effects, such as fatigue or a loss of interest in sex. The authors also question the methods used by drug companies to test new antidepressants. This scholarly and provocative article is clearly written, so look it up if you are curious. My own clinical experience has convinced me that pure test tube treatment with drugs alone is not the answer for most patients. There appears to be a definite role for effective psychological interventions, even if you have had the good fortune to respond to an antidepressant medication. If you learn cognitive therapy self-help techniques like those described in this book, I believe you will be better prepared to cope with any mood problems that develop again in the future. My clinical practice has always been predicated on an integrated approach. At my clinic in Philadelphia, approximately 60% of our patients received cognitive therapy with no drugs, and approximately 40% of our patients received a combination of cognitive therapy along with antidepressants. Patients in both groups did well, and we found both types of treatment tools to be valuable. We did not treat patients with drugs alone and no psychotherapy because, in my experience, this approach has not been satisfactory. It may be that for certain types of depression, the addition of the proper antidepressant to help your treatment program might make you more amenable to a rational self-help program and greatly speed up the therapy. As I've mentioned earlier above, I can think of many depressed individuals who seem to see the light with regard to their illogical, twisted, negative thoughts more rapidly once they began taking an antidepressant. My own philosophy is this. I'm in favor of any reasonably safe tool that will help you. I believe that your feelings about the type of treatment that you receive may be important to the outcome. If you are more biologically oriented, you may do better with drug treatment. In contrast, if you are more psychologically oriented, you may do better with psychotherapy. If you and your therapist do not see eye to eye, you may lose confidence and resist the treatment, and this can reduce the chances for a successful result. In contrast, if the treatment makes sense to you, you will feel more hope, trust, and confidence in your doctor. Consequently, your chances for a positive outcome will be increased. I have also seen that certain negative attitudes and irrational thoughts can interfere with proper drug treatment or with psychotherapeutic treatment. I would like to expose 12 hurtful myths at this time. The first 8 myths concern medication treatment, and the last 4 myths concern psychotherapy. With regard to medications, I believe that enlightened caution in taking any drug is well advised, but an excessively conservative attitude based on half-truths can be equally destructive. I also believe that one should be appropriately skeptical and cautious about psychotherapy, but that too much pessimism can also interfere with effective treatment. Myth number 1. If I take this drug, I won't be my true self. I'll act strange and feel unusual. Nothing could be further from the truth. Although these drugs can sometimes eliminate depression, they do not usually create abnormal mood elevations, and except in rare cases, they will not make you feel abnormal, strange, or high. In fact, many patients report that they feel much more like themselves after they take an antidepressant medication. Myth number 2. These drugs are extremely dangerous. Wrong. If you are receiving medical supervision and cooperate with your doctor, you will have no reason to fear most antidepressant drugs. Adverse reactions are rare and can usually be safely and effectively managed when you and your doctor work together as a team. The antidepressants are far safer than the depression itself. After all, depression, if left untreated, can kill through suicide. This does not mean you should be complacent about antidepressant drugs or any drug you take for that matter, including aspirin. In the following chapters, you will learn about the side effects and toxic effects of all the different antidepressants and mood-stabilizing agents. If you are taking one or more of these drugs, educate yourself and read about them in Chapter 20. This should not be difficult, and the information will enhance your chances of having a safe and effective experience with the antidepressant your doctor has prescribed. Myth number 3. But the side effects will be intolerable. No, the side effects are mild and can usually be made barely noticeable by adjusting the dose properly. If in spite of this you find the medication uncomfortable, you can usually switch to another medication that will be equally effective with fewer side effects. Remember, too, that untreated depression also has many side effects. These include feelings of tiredness, increases or decreases in appetite, difficulty sleeping, a loss of motivation and energy, a loss of interest in sex, and so forth. And if you respond favorably to an antidepressant, these side effects will usually disappear. Myth number 4. But I'm bound to get out of control and use these drugs to commit suicide. Some of the antidepressant drugs do have a lethal potential if you take them in overdose or combine them with certain other drugs. But this need not be a problem if you discuss your concerns with your physician. If you feel actively suicidal, it might be helpful to obtain only a few days or 1 week's supply at a time. Then you will not be likely to have a lethal supply on hand. Your doctor may also decide to treat you with one of the newer antidepressant drugs that are much safer than the older antidepressants if taken an accidental or intentional overdose. Remember that as the drug begins to work, you will feel less suicidal. You should also see your therapist frequently and receive intensive therapy, either as an outpatient or as an inpatient, until any suicidal urges have passed. Myth number 5. I'll become hooked and addicted like the junkies on the street. If I ever try to go off the drug, I'll fall apart again. I'll be stuck with this crutch forever. Wrong again. Unlike sleeping pills, opiates, barbiturates, and minor tranquilizers, benzodiazepines, the addictive potential of antidepressants is extremely low. Once the drug is working, you will not need to take larger doses to maintain the antidepressant effect. As noted above, if you are learning cognitive therapy techniques and focusing on relapse prevention, In most instances, your depression will not return when you discontinue the drug. When it is time to go off the medicine, it would be advisable to do this gradually, tapering off over a week or two. This will minimize any discomfort that might occur from abruptly stopping the medicine and will help you nip any relapse in the bud before it becomes full-blown. Many doctors now advocate long-term maintenance